Welcome to the Dash Arts podcast, seeing the world through an artistic lens. I'm Josephine Burton, and I'm speaking to you from a farm in somewhere in Sussex, where we're spending the evening with musician Sam Lee, and we're going on a journey into the woods to listen to the nightingales.
We're very lucky to have this weather so early in the season. We're like way ahead as well, about 2 weeks ahead, plants-wise. Though the nightingales have just arrived about a week and a bit ago and are singing amazingly, so that's really good news. They seem very happy. Some of you might have no clue on what on earth you're doing here, what's about to happen, but there's a bit of a journey we're going to go on into many realms and introduce you to the land. Feed you delicious food, play music, tell stories, and more. So if you want to come and join me, we'll go on a little stroll. Mm-hmm. And, go and listen to the birds. Mm. Is everyone good?
Yeah.
Great. We're recording tonight, in case you hadn't noticed. I should have probably said she's not listening to drum and bass. It's like,
yeah. Or am I?
Or are you? Nightingales are a little bit like drum. They're more like a kind of techno, though, actually, than drum and bass.
Repetitive.
You've been more, yeah. great. Coming a little bit closer, because then I don't have to holler across you all. Great, I thought I'd bring us to this spot because this is wonderful for birdsong, more so when 30 people don't charge into the middle of their territory. But there's the blackbird. So the blackbirds are going into their alarm call, which is a very preceding darkness. That kind of rising up. You often, if you're walking and you disturb a blackbird, they'll fly diagonally upwards. So we've got this amazing rising up of the evening chorus in preparation for night, and I just want to maybe paint a little picture of what's going on here, but across the surface of the earth right now on this shadow line. If you imagine we were to lift off out of Sussex into space and look down, we'd see this you know, dark encroaching shadow heading west. If you were to listen down onto that shadow line, what you'd see is preceding it is this enormous wave of song kind of surging up like a kind of tidal bore, like a kind of tsunami of song as the birds are preempting nighttime. And this is exactly contiguous with that entire longitudinal line going down through Western Europe. And somewhere over east, it's dark in, you know, Germany or Central Europe already, and all the birds have gone very quiet. In fact, probably somewhere around Germany and Romania,
definitely 2 hours ahead.
2 hours ahead, no, not quite. So, even further east, the nightingales will be starting up because they are also matching the time of, they like a little bit of time after darkness. So, maybe slightly even further east, the nightingales will be like, it's our time. And the English ones are, they have hours, they're doing their makeup. Still in their dressing rooms. The bird song here is all male song, so it's all the male birds defending territory. Almost all of the songbirds are the males that sing, with one exception, which is the robin that has a winter song. The female has a winter song. There are many sounds that the females make, but within what we call true song, it's the male doing the courtship and the territorial song. That's a little bit about the bird kind of language here, but there's so much more that's being spoken. Because what I'm saying there is what the kind of ornithological, this is what birds, there's alarm calls, there's contact calls, there's feeding calls, there's song and there's mating calls, and that's basically roughly what they're doing. We all know that's total nonsense and that there is as much detail in conversation here as any of us on a more articulate day.
Beautiful.
Who knows what that is?
Sunset.
Is it?
No, it's
Missile
thrush.
Oh.
Yeah.
Much harsher.
Yeah. It's kind of sad to leave here. That's the last robin, one of the last of the singers. Alright, I'll lead us back. You can ask me any questions on our way. We're going to go down that route there.
Well, the night fast approaching to the woods he resorted, with woodbine and ivy his bed for to make. There he dreamt about sighing, lamenting and crying, "Go home to your family and your ramblings forsake. On the 5th of November I've a reason to remember when first he arrived at his family's front door. Well, they looked so surprised when first he arrived to behold such a stranger once more in their sight. And his children came around him with their brittle prattling stories. With their brittle prattling stories to drive cares away. Now they are united like birds of one feather, like bees in one hive, contented they'll be. Contented is he, and he'll go rambling no more.
It is the ballad of Spencer the Rover. It's a song from just down the road from here, down on the coast. Rottingdean, Sussex song from the Copper family. Wonderful singers who I'm sure some of you will know of, still singing as they have done for over 400 years, the shepherding songs, the Downs songs, the Sussex songs of these lands, and feels in many ways the song that I want to open tonight with, because it speaks of so many aspects of what we are doing here, why we are here, what we are experiencing, and all that is stirring around us right now, within us too. It's a song that speaks quite unusually of a man in a state of desperation, of depression. Unusual for its reference in folk song, not a subject that's often dealt with, but he's reduced and confused. He has a wife and family, and he's squandered his gold and jewels, and he's found himself destitute, on the road, wandering aimlessly. He's lost, he's sick in heart and mind. And it's his encountering of the cool water of the spring, his encounter with nature, that begins this journey of restoration, of healing. He is taken into the woods, resorts to the woods, and we are resorting tonight ourselves. And there in the darkness, he is wrapped in the woodbine and the ivy, the honeysuckle and the ivy. These two creepers encase him into his cocoon, where he goes on what I call the English shamanic journey, this metamorphosis, this purging of his ills and his sorrows and his sickness. And he falls into a state of tumult and terror, weeping and sighing and crying out into the night. And in this peak of distress comes the voice
Go home to your family and your ramblings forsake. So the song says. That's the theme of tonight, coming home. That's what's happening right now. All around us, the birds have returned from their mighty journey from sub-Saharan Africa. Not just the nightingales, the chiff-chaffs, the cuckoos, the blackcaps, many others. They felt that twitch of the feather at some point just a few weeks ago to say it's time to make this long journey back to the very spot that they were born in, the very thicket that these nightingales emerged from an egg a season or two ago, however old they are. They've come back to where they know, where they need to be. As far east as Western Mongolia and as far west as East Devon, we listen to nightingales. And that impact of a bird song, sung so sweetly in the silence of the night, is a perfect, quintessential spring night, not a breath of wind. Total stillness, bar a Boeing 737. Only interrupted by the sound of nightingales and perhaps a tawny owl and maybe a nightjar and a lapwing too, but it's the nightingales that we hold so close to our sense of as the harbinger of the new year, harbinger of the spring, a bird of fecundity, of fertility, a bird of new life. So we shall soon be listening to them, but in the time that we have until they start their magnificent night chorus, we have these hours to while away with songs and stories in preparation for the great arias that we'll be fortunate enough to hear. So thank you, everyone. Thank you for coming and daring into this archaic, ancient, and yet very now space. This is something that we do need to do more. Do you agree?
Yes.
Amen. Well, I'm going to hand over to the wonderful Jack Dirtnell to play us some songs and tell us some stories. And you're here. Thank you, Jack.
Thank you.
Thing the males do, it's the males that arrive first, is set up home in look for their territory. If their territory has been claimed by a brother, maybe one of the
the season brothers from the season before, a half brother most likely, because it will be a different fathers every time. I never really thought about that. They've always got lots of half brothers, but very rarely any full brothers. And they will start singing almost as soon as they've arrived. It's always a little bit hesitant to start, but depending on the wind direction, we've had really soft, warm south-easterly winds and southwesterly winds. If it's coming from below, that helps bring the females over, and they're singing upwards and outwards in the night time extremely loudly, 90 decibels. They're a very powerful bird, to let the females know where they are, so that as they migrate and the females come in many different waves and are moving around looking for territory, they hear the male, they inspect the song first, they judge whether the song is strong and virile, whether it's got muscularity, an indicator that the bird has worked hard to find a very good patch, full of food and a good place, safe place to raise their young, because they're ground nesters that need to be densely protected, hence the blackthorn, all that coppice. It needs to be really impenetrable and hidden away. And then eventually they'll mate, and the minute they mate, the male stops singing. And he stops singing, with the rare exception of a little bit of day song, but particularly singing to impart his song onto his young while they're still in the egg.
Mm-hmm.
So the birds will learn, receive their repertoire. And we know this from studies, not of nightingales, but of other birds, particularly the zebra finches, that if you remove an egg once born and isolate it from the parental song, then they don't develop their song. It becomes this corrupted, very sort of unevolved song. So they're listening through the shell, both to their parents, but also to others. The males will continue to sing all the way through to the end of May here, in hopes of a mate. And if they don't find a mate, they eventually give up and go quiet. So it's really around the first week in June that night song falls off. In places where there are more nightingales, like Knepp Estate or some of the big nature reserves, like kind of nightingale nightclub, they will sing on and on, because they're so, they're very social birds. They love singing. The males love singing with each other. And they're being very sociable at the moment as well, which is wonderful. You'll hear the call and response, and the way that they share repertoire and imitate each other and pass messages down the hedge line. So there's an enormous amount of collaborativeness. There are many different personalities of males and different songs, and it's their repertoire of song which is so formidable. They have a repertoire of around 1,500 different sounds. And within those sounds, they will combine them to about 200, up to about 250 different phrases. And they never repeat, so they're constantly reforming, improvising upon their expressions. Always leaving this silence. So they're sing, 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 quiet. Sing, 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 sing. It's this on and off. Well, I call it the decoration of silence. That is so artistic and so human-like in that sense of choice and placement. So the artistry in them is exceedingly intelligent, and that's where their evolutionary journey has sent them, to perfect this song and be the night singer.
To crave blissful bird on me, durava, oh grace to me, mi grave. bird on a bright bird on a tree. Nature comes, oh love, love to beg. Blissful bird on me have pity, oh pray grant me my grave, pray grant me my grave.
In modern English, bird on a briar. But it's actually our oldest surviving written secular song in a complete lyric. And it comes from the end of the 13th century, beginning of the 14th century, near Exeter in a priory where a monk or a brother there wrote on the back of a 100-year-old papal bull this beautiful melody. No one knows where it came from, if he composed it, if it was a folk song. But the play on words in the Middle English, brid on a brera. Brid is the word for bird, but it sounds like bridey, like Bridget. It also sounds like birid, which is the word at that time for a woman. So you may kiss the bride. It's actually that you may kiss the woman that you're marrying, if you're marrying. So it's this really intricate wordplay, and it's really singing to this bird, but is the bird the woman? Is this a personification of the love? And it's a very rich interweaving of language, which gets lost in the modern English, but yeah, it's a beautiful song.
I'd like to just take these last few minutes to prepare us to head down, but we're not going to use torches. We're going to go in complete silence, in single file, on a meditative walk of about half an hour maybe, very slowly. It's a bit boggy in parts, but we're going to go, I'm going to take us through the forest on a windy path and enter out into where the nightingales are singing. And we're going to gather around, and Jack and me are going to enter into this collaboration, this communion with the bird, where you will hear they are very aware of us being here, and they're very accepting of our music and very playful with us too. We will be sitting very close to them, very close, unbelievably. I invite stillness into this experience. We have stools, we're going to give them to you when we do the little safety briefing before we leave. We'll have a little break in a moment. We've got walking sticks should you need some extra support. And call us in over there, or carry a lantern and beckon us in.
You guys come up close. I just want to do a bit of a last.
Oh, wow.
Oh, do you know what that was? Oh, that was the most terrifying sounds of them all. It was an owl, but what type of owl was it?
Barn owl.
Yeah. The screech owl. It was a barn owl. Oh my god, I'm scared now.
God, I've got you guys. So, little last safety briefing, because we are going to be a long line, and we're going to move as a wolf pack does, which means we're going to walk with the slowest members of the family up front, so you help set the place. So if you identify as slow elder wolf, come up with Jack and me, and that way you can you won't get left behind. Any other questions? All good? Great, let's get going.
Temperature has changed.
I think it has just really dropped. I came back yesterday and it just felt freezing. From Lewis, because I stayed at my friend Masha's house.
Oh yeah, oh who came?
Masha came. Having not, I lost her in 2019. And we were so, you know, and so I was really thrilled. And I sort of messaged her and said, I'm going to do, you know, you don't fancy coming. She's like, I've been meaning to go to the woods. I've been meaning to hear the nightingales for so long. And she's going to come along. I think she'll book and bring her sisters.
Thanks for having a chat, your levels are fine.
Okay, so most of the time I see Sam in a very urban environment of London, and so I've actually caught up with him in Dalston, in just behind the garden, behind his house, his flat, and so I thought we'd, before we go back and hear more from our experience in the woods, it would be nice to sort of see you here. Mm-hmm. Thank you for hosting us.
Oh, thanks for coming to me.
So a couple of days ago Sam and I were in the woods in a farm in Lewis, and it was my first experience of hearing the nightingales. It was incredibly magical.
Well, the night you came, like most of the nights, it was really special. I mean, it's kind of like nature at nature's best. It was the leaves weren't quite on the trees, so there was moonshine pouring through the woods. You had full stars. It was absolute mill pond still, and the nightingales sang so beautifully. We actually went to hear a nightingale that I'd never heard before that night. I moved away from the one that we'd been working with for that week and found a new one, and took us on up onto the railway line, a slightly different place than we've been yet.
How many people normally come on the experience who, like me, who've never heard the nightingale before?
So every night I do ask how many people have heard a nightingale before, and like the night before you, none had. There was 40 people, none had ever heard a nightingale. Your night had, you know, 5, 6, 7 hands went up. Yeah. So it's really interesting. It varies. Most of the time it's a tiny percentage. So, you know, adding that all up to the number of people that come through, which is 1,200, it's probably only about 40 or 50 in total who have ever heard a bird. So it's a tiny, tiny fraction of the audience.
I think the first time I heard it so clearly, we were walking through the woods, and as you say, it was so beautiful. We were, you know, we'd been encouraged to turn our phones off. So it was just, we sort of slowly making our way through this very, very silent wood. And I was quite disorientated initially, because I was like, physically, I'm used to hearing birdsong in the day, and it's clearly night, and I, you know, I'm sort of watching my footsteps as I go, and I can barely see anything, and I'm feeling a bit tired. And yeah, this is the sound that you associate with like daylight, life, a busyness. And I caught myself physically having a strange reaction to it.
Yeah, and I feel it the same. There's something contrary about it, that at a time where we associate with such quietness, there's something wild going on. Yeah. And it's almost as though at first nature's off kilter, and actually then you realize no, it's that we're off kilter, because our baseline is that this is not a time of activity. Actually, that's totally wrong. The night's a very noisy time. It's just we don't ever have that opportunity to listen. We've come to some sort of assumption that's what it's like where we live usually.
Yeah. And so how did it all begin for it? Like, why did you establish it, and how?
Well, it's grown from 10 years ago when I first went to that site. I went down to the woods, was tipped off they had birds, because I was asked to make a little program on Radio 4 to honour the 90th anniversary of the famous first ever live radio broadcaster, which was Beatrice Harrison, the cellist, and a nightingale. That will be 100 years this year.
This month, right?
In May, yeah. May 19th. And I went down with the musicians and we holed up in miserable weather with the nightingale right next to us. And we started making music. And while we were doing that, the nightingale audibly got louder and started to adapt his song to what we were playing. And this was such a surprise. I'd only listened to the birds, I never made music with them, that I realised there and then this was something quite phenomenal and people needed to hear it. So the next year I was in touch with Brighton Festival and they wanted me to do something. I said, well, how about we try these concerts outside? And they were really game and they put, 60 tickets up and they sold in about 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And so the next year I was like, okay, I'm doing this myself. And it's grown from my mate cooking over the fire for about 20 people to 40 events in 7 weeks for about 1,500 people. Yeah, so it's really grown and grown and become, a campaign.
So that famous recording, the cellist, I understand now, wasn't actually duetting.
It was. It's fake news that it wasn't. It's very, very. It's been totally it was a erroneous bit of journalism.
I'm really happy to hear. I mean, I'm happy for us to like, for the podcast, but also just, it's a beautiful story. And so presumably then when Francesca, who I know is a cellist, she was walking in like some serious footsteps then taking the cello into the woods.
It was a grey, slightly drizzly day, and sometimes walking in footsteps is not always a comfortable experience. But I think they were all really quite surprised, like I was, when they started playing, and this bird just completely latched on. And they've both been back. Flora and Fran have both come back and played with the nightingale since, which has been really nice. So they've had a chance to do it on their own because they were doing a string section at the time, so it wasn't improvising so much.
So I love that your sort of instinct that the nightingale adapts their song in conversation with and in collaboration with the artist, because I was really sort of grappling as I was listening. I was trying to kind of work out whether there was what the relationship was, whether it was responding, whether it was trying to drown you out. There was a rivalry in the singing. I'm really interested. Do you play in your head with what's going on for the nightingale? I mean, do you have different interpretations every time?
So the thing I asked the artist to do, and that I have to stay well away from, is going into my head. It's very easy to project human attitudes, Western human attitudes, mm-hmm. onto what's going on to try and scientifically interpret. And there is so much more that is happening within birdsong. And we can try and reduce it to rivalry, competitive, collaborative. But the times where the magic really happens with a musician is when you know that they are being so heart-led, and the musicians that have this kind of wild connection with a wild bird, and the bird recognises that. It's a different response every time, and some musicians there's mutuality. And I don't want to say what that is, because the musician will say it's different mm-hmm. to what I'll say it was, and there's no way of ever knowing. It's all up for interpretation.
And do you... I could really feel that listening to you both, you and Jack, and I could feel the dance that you were playing with each other as well as with the bird. And I particularly felt the moment that Jack played the whistle, if something just shifted for me. I don't know whether there's something shifted definitely in the relationship between the bird, the nightingale at that moment, and the whistle. And I wondered if there were certain instruments that you could feel, like, are there certain instruments that which is tangibly different? Or do you think it's more meant kind of a heart space for the artist?
Yeah. I always say that you can have, you know, three cellos in a row and the bird will react differently every night. It's not about the instrument, it's about the player. What I will say about Jack, because he worked on alto sax, penny whistle and voice, and a sax, the reeded instruments, it's quite hard when it's very cold and you've got an instrument that doesn't work well in those conditions. Tough instrument to get through. That I think that when he worked on the whistle, he was just a bit more fleet-footed. Well, often the ones that come from a spiritual or devotional practice in their music are a kind of religious music that is improvised, that people who don't come from a classical music notation background, and the ones that have a kind of natural sense of wildness in them.
Yeah, I can feel, I mean, I completely get that. And also you have a very unique relationship to nature yourself. And I guess that's part, I mean, there are many reasons why it's lovely to speak to you for this podcast and create a podcast out of it. And part of it is because at Dash at the moment we're doing this program called Albion, thinking about Englishness. And we've spent the last year working with people across the country, asking them what they feel passionate about, what they want to change, and thinking about, like, the country through the people. And I thought it would be really interesting for us to sort of have a kind of parallel program thinking about the landscape that will evolve over the next few years. And that's really, really special to speak to, because I think you really have a very unique relationship with the landscape and how it affects you as an artist. Do you want to speak to that?
Well, indeed. The thing is, I think this is the, you know, it's easy for me to say this because I'm greatly in love with nature, and we have a country with the most extraordinary variety for such a small land masses of ecosystems, of types of topography and geography and biology. And but I think that landscape is, and geology, and, you know, and the natural world is one of the most influential definers of identity for so many reasons. It has been maybe more so in the past and less so now that we live a more detached life and more defined by the media that we consume or that we identify with. But I still think we discount how much place and the ecology of place influences who we are and how we relate to each other, and define ourselves as, you know, as from here or different to over there. And I don't think that's an excluding thing, that you have to be born and raised, you know, of the land. I, like you, have not got a drop of British blood in me, that I feel entirely indigenous to these lands. And that's what indigenous means. It means nascence, comes from the word nascence, birth, from to where you are born. But I think it's also that idea of where you're born is about where you've had critical experiences or put the time in to be reborn, to find a sense of the mother, you know, the other mother, not just your birth mother, but your earth mother. And that's why I think that we are in a time now where we're really reckoning with actually what is the ecology of our land, where is it struggling, where does it need us to be more connected, engaged, and developing senses of kinship, and how much is that actually part of a more healthy form of identity.
And your way of understanding that and exploring that is through yourself as an artist, right? Because you're a musician and a thinker and a writer. Would you say that's your life work as an artist, then, to explore that?
Yes.
That was a very loaded question, wasn't it? Is it your life work?
I don't know. I might do like a hip-hop album one day. No, it very much is. And I don't think I ever realised quite... I knew there were all these different strands, but they're only kind of in recent years starting to come together to for me to feel like, God, what is my purpose? You know, what is my one offering? And you can't do it all, so but this is where I'm most passionate, because it was the realm that helped me discover who I was. And and I also think we are not aware of how much our existence depends on it, and this is one of the singular most important issues that we as a species are facing, and all other issues are entwined and are irrelevant or not so much irrelevant, but are helpless if we don't identify our relationship with nature as being the one that we need to protect and work on the most. And it solves so many other problems in its doing.
You tread very lightly with that as a responsibility. We all felt quite held. You know, we were learning a little bit about our responsibilities to look after nature at the same time as sitting around the campfire listening to some lovely music. But it's definitely something, obviously, that you feel a responsibility to do.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about being an artist is that you want people to like you, first and foremost. So you gravitate towards the kind of, you know, the popular, the more popular ways of doing things, and not that I ever want to do the obvious, but what I'm aware is, in all the years of activism that I have done, the shouting, the ranting, the telling people they're bad is the most ineffective way, because it just ingrains people in a sense of couldn't care less. And actually what I'm trying to do is to make people care more. And if you're going to make people care, you have to make them fall in love. And I love this, being a conduit to that. I feel like I'm a little bit of a kind of Cupid, trying to shoot arrows between them and the nightingale, them and the land.
I think people really did feel like they were caring more. There was this beautiful moment, I don't know if you heard, a French lullaby emerged from where I was standing, this individual started teaching us the song of the cuckoo and the owl.
I just keep thinking there's this lovely French children's song which is about the cuckoo speaking to the owl, because cuckoo and hibou.
How does it go?
Dans la forêt lointaine, on entend le coucou.
Coucou.
Du haut de son grand chêne, il répond hibou.
Coucou, 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 coucou.
And so on. There you go.
I remember
the hibou
that song.
Goes and it's hoo hoo.
Yeah. And what's the hibou?
So, well, it's just like, yeah, so same again.
Well, what is the hibou bird?
Oh, owl.
An owl.
Yeah. That's all right.
Sorry, keep going.
No, it's fine.
Lovely. you were doing a duet then, it sounded lovely.
Yeah, and then you do it in a round.
Yeah.
And it sounds
like.
Can
you sing it?
No, there's proper musicians.
Let's come in to hear it.
Yeah, I'll actually come over.
He wants to listen.
I'll sing along with you.
I'll sing with you by the
end. Dans la forêt lointaine, on entend le hibou. Du haut de son grand chêne, il répond coucou. Coucou, 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 coucou. Dans la forêt lointaine, on entend le coucou. Du haut de son grand chêne, il répond au hibou. Coucou, 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 coucou.
Those are the moments that I love, because they're the revelations that we've all got our own private moment from somewhere in our history, where we have where we have a cultural gift, and that gift suddenly holds new relevance when it's put into context of the place where the owl and the cuckoo sing. You know, cuckoo's a night singer as well. And it's always wonderful when one has these, you know, these jewels that have been inspired through the natural world, but then taken into the home and into the, you know, the indoor space, and then suddenly they're kind of rewilded. And we realize, oh my God, what this song means by nature of it being released back into the wild. And that's part of what I'm doing, is the kind of rewilding of the folk songs, taking them back to the place from where they're inspired and out of the folk clubs and the concert rooms and that sort of thing, which are, you know, in many ways glorious prisons for some of this music. I'm very pleased to hear that, and I think what I'm hoping is that this work chimes with memories and places of exquisiteness and awe and wonder, and is able to be activated in the sense of, God, that's something that's an important memory, that's an important song.
Can I ask you something different about the nightingales? There was something you said when they, and I, there's something absolutely kind of exquisitely gorgeous about this nightingale that lives 9 months of the year in the Sahara, I would say, nine, ten months of the year, so whatever, something like that, and then flies back in order to roost, in order to like lay eggs and have young, and then go, and then they return. And my understanding from what you were saying, and I'm learning from you, Sam, was that they return to the place that they were born in order to roost and have, in mate and roost and yeah, birth their young, and then they fly off again. And the way that you, when you talked about coming home, it was really interesting, because of course, like, it's a home, it's only a home for a really minimal amount of the, like, the time of the year. And I was thinking, like, it's like the non-doms. It's all like, you know, like, you know, Rachel Reeves going after the non-doms because they're barely ever here. The nightingales are barely ever here, but they call it home.
Yeah.
Or you call it home.
Well, I do, but then I often say that they're an African bird that flies to England for the summer.
So it depends on the night.
It does, okay. Totally. But I think they open up that sense of, well, why can they be dual citizens of multiple places, and why are we so boxed in and confined by borders? They don't see any borders. They fly over several in one night's work. And, you know, they are... So that word migrant suddenly, for them, they challenge all the preconceptions of what that means. We embrace the fact that they do this incredible feat and we celebrate it, yet when humans do it, it's suddenly complex and subversive or extractive challenging. And so I think there's a lot to learn from that about how can actually we imagine the positive side of what migrancy means, and support it and honour it, that they do it out of a need, that their food sources become hard to find, and they move on to places of opportunity, and there's a lot of benefit that they give, you know, the positive that they bring is so enormous, and yet we don't acknowledge that within human migrants, that of all that they can support, you know, local communities, the non-migrants, you know, the settled folk. So it's, you know, I'm not going to go into the politics of that, but I think they hold an important lessons for us.
Heard a fine song.
It was sung by a fair maid. Her voice was low and clear. Saying how happy would I be if my true love was here. In a few moments after, my young love passed by. She had red, rosy cheeks and a rolling blue eyes. Expecting this evening, true lovers would meet. So we gang along together till we come unto a shade where the leaves they spread over and scarcely can be heard. But it's no longer in your company this evening amen. That the hard rocks may open and never more to close. That the pale moon may darken and show us no light. That the bright star of heaven should fall down. That's the hour our proof falls to you. You're my blooming red
rose.
My thanks to Sam and to the Nightingales and to the whole of the Singing with Nightingales team, who looked after us all so beautifully and escorted us around and held our hands so that we didn't stumble in the mud and cook beautiful food. Thank you hugely to Jack Durnall and his beautiful music and the whole group of us who were with us in the woods, who shared their own reflections and humoured us with our microphones. Thank you for listening, and if you like the Dash Arts podcast, please write a review, share it with your friends, because your support means the world to us. Thank you.